everyone, and welcome to minute 47 of season 7 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again is Sean German from the Next Scene Pod. Welcome back to the show, Sean.
Oh, thank you for having me. Glad to be back.
Yeah. It's been so good so far. Just call me through the switchboard if you need anything.
Mm-hmm.
So minute 47 begins with Cobb finally acting friendly to John, and ends with a whole bunch of policemen dispersing. So basically, we ended things yesterday with Simon explaining the situation and Cobb taking command and realizing what he needs to do in order to deal with this particular situation. And, you know, he's getting a little bit of help from the FBI and from everyone else, but he really has taken control here. You know, mm-hmm. he's in charge. No, there's no question about it. You know, if there's someone going to be dealing with this, it's going to be Cobb, which I actually like finally seeing, because, you know, he's pretty much acted in a really nasty way to John. And also I haven't been shy about the fact that I didn't like the way that he's always been pandering to Simon, you know? Mm-hmm. So finally we see that he's actually doing his job and taking charge with the things. And so I liked finally seeing that, in yesterday's episode, which goes into today's. So then basically, Cobb then turns to John and says, Tompkins Square Park is more than 2 miles away, so you guys better get running. And then he says, no radios. You take my telephone. And he hands him his telephone. And then he says, you get anything, you call me through the switchboard. Good luck. So it's actually quite funny, because if you think about it, I mean, we're in 2024, we understand cell phones a lot better than people did in 1994 or 95, depending on when this takes place, right? And so, you know, for Cobb to give John his phone and say, okay, if you need to make a call, then use it. It's obviously very generous. But what happens if, you know, Simon wants to call? Because Simon called Cobb's cell phone. So he's not going to be able to get in touch with Simon and with Cobb. He's, you know, going to get John if he calls him, and that depends also on, you know, how long the battery will last. You know, they don't even bring that in here. It's like, take my phone and run around the city all day. You know, from what I recall, batteries weren't as didn't last as long back then as they do today. My memory could be wrong about that, but that's what I believe.
Yeah, it's. No, I didn't they were both have here. My first yeah, I didn't have my first cell phone until like 98, 99, you know, so it'd been a few years. But at least from that period, my memory is, although the battery, you know, the battery technology and the battery capacity was not as much and the batteries weighed a lot more, you actually got a longer life because the phones weren't doing as much.
Okay, you know, nowadays, to that also. Right.
Yeah, so nowadays, you know, it's I mean, if you have a phone that will go, you know, all day, you know, that will go 24 hours, that's considered good battery life. But it's got, you know, you can surf the web, it's got a GPS, it's got all kind of other stuff going on. Back then, when phones just made calls and really weren't doing anything in the background, if you weren't, you know, when you weren't using them, phones would last a few days. But again, that's kind of a few days on standby if you're not making calls. I don't know. You know, if you know, their only way to communicate, you know, they can't use their radio. So the only way to communicate would be either, through the, you know, mobile phone or pay phone. I'm not sure how much, you know, how fast actually using the phone would run down the battery.
Right. Yeah. But, again, it's to me, it seems a little, callous and a little problematic just to give them your phone and say, here, you know, use this whenever you need it. From what, especially since we saw these are bulky phones. You know, this isn't I'm trying to remember if John ever even uses it later on. I right now
Yeah,
can't recall.
I don't think he does. Well, and also, how is he supposed to get back to Cobb? So it's through the switchboard. So McClane uses the phone, calls the switchboard, and then how does, the switchboard somehow has to get the message through to Cobb?
That's right. And the
Like
switchboard is
it,
like,
yeah.
where's Tom? Well, the answer of the switchboard would say, oh, we'll just call his cell phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, no, this is, it would seem more important for Cobb to have a phone, the point you were making about being able to get in touch with Cobb. Like, can't he ask, one of the other officials or even one of the FBI agents, like ask anyone else to that they might have a phone that they can give to McClane. Yeah, it seems like being in touch with Cobb would be important.
Right. Again,
Yeah.
I think that the reason that this is here is as a gesture to show us that that Cobb is back on John's side.
Yeah,
No.
and I like this. This is a good, and you touched on it a little bit earlier. A good contrast to, like particularly Robinson in the first Die Hard, in terms of like even at no point he never comes around. He's never friendly towards John. He's always antagonistic, and he's always, a bit incompetent. Which not like I'm not the biggest booster of police and all that stuff, but. Yeah, they don't have to be complete jerks all the time. Like it makes sense for them to recognize, okay, there's a real situation, and this guy John McClane, he may not be the best, the best officer on paper in terms of by the book and the rules and everything, but obviously he knows something about the situation and can contribute. And like, let's give this guy the benefit of the doubt and not necessarily be a jerk to him from beginning to end, the
Right.
way we've seen in the previous diehards.
Correct. No, and again, I think it's also part of the fact that I mean, we also have Lorenzo in here. You know, where Lorenzo didn't also gave John a really hard time up until John tried shooting him. You know, and at that point he became his best friend. So
Right.
oh,
Yeah.
you almost killed
Yeah.
me? Oh, okay, no problem. Now we'll be friendly too. So yeah, this is but the difference is that Cobb is John's immediate superior. You know, both
Right,
Robinson and Lorenzo were, were foreign entities.
Right.
You
Yeah, and
know.
that's one of the things I like particularly about this film is we get to see John in his, on his home turf. He's not in LA or DC anymore. It's the New York City cop in New York City doing his New York thing. But yeah, so that makes sense. They'd have more of a history and they'd know more, and I guess, jurisdictional issues wouldn't be as much a problem when he's actually in. I know he's actually in his city where he worked as a cop, so
Right, but
a little bit different there.
also you have the aspect that Cobb knows John and knows his work. He knows what he's going to get from John. Both Lorenzo and Robinson didn't know what they were going to get from John.
True.
You know, I
True.
mean, obviously, Al Powell was able to understand that, but the others, the people who are who John is theoretically a subordinate to, were the ones who didn't get it. So it's
Right.
interesting to think about it from that perspective.
Yeah, a lot of differences, reasons for the different dynamic, certainly.
Yeah, exactly. And then at this point, Cobb continues to take control, and John says thanks, and he goes, "Find that bomb." And
Find that bomb.
then Cobb turns to and goes, "Ricky, where are they?"
Right over here.
So then Ricky whispers to him, "The senior man present is Chief Allen." "Chief of what?" "Transit." And then
Transit.
he has like a smirk on his face, like, oh my God, type of thing. And he says, "Okay, thanks, Ricky." So then Cobb starts talking to the group. You know, he's in front of a group of cops, including this Chief Allen. And he goes, "Gentlemen, we have a decision to make. Chief Allen, the man who has done this has told us that he has planted another very large bomb in a school here in the New York area. And he has told us that we cannot evacuate, but he has not said that we cannot search. Now, I recommend we get everybody. I mean, everybody. I'm talking about police, transit, sanitation, fire, even the goddamn librarians. And we start searching schools. And I mean, right now. I'm talking about 1,000 buildings within the city limits. And we have 3 hours and 15 minutes to do it in." Now, I'd like to keep the media out of this as long as possible, because if they get in, we've got to panic. Are we in agreement? And everyone just like grumbles. And he goes, come on, guys, let's go. So first of all, it's a great speech. He definitely is doing this as to rally the troops type of speech with the way that he does it. But what I found really strange is that why is he saying they have 1,000 buildings to go through if we know that there are 1,446 schools? Does that mean that the 446 schools are located on the same premises of other schools? Or he's trying to maybe the, or he's trying to keep them calm by saying it's only 1,000, not close to 1,500.
Yeah. He's just rounding down to make it seem more manageable. Maybe those, you know, you got 400 schools where there's no kids of FBI agents, so it's like, I'm guessing he's just rounding it down to keep, you know, a nice round number to keep the speech even and everything. Yeah.
No, I think it's just to keep people from getting a little overexcited. That, you know, it'd be like, okay, we have to search 1,446 schools. And it'd be like, what? No. So then he goes, no, it's just 1,000. Oh, okay. It's only 1,000, then that's okay. That we can do.
But I like, there's a lot in this minute that helped me as a viewer kind of orient myself in terms of where we are. And I like that. It's something that I find missing in a lot of films in terms of, well, one, what Cobb is doing, to know that there's stuff going on. There's a lot of films that are movies I've seen where there's like some big event and we're focused on, you know, protagonist, a single protagonist or a small group, but it's the kind of thing where it's like other people would be involved. Other people would notice the events of the film that never get mentioned or don't seem to be an issue in any way. But here they're, you know, explicitly telling us, we're going to be focused on McClane and Zeus and, what, you know, they're the main focus, but the city is responding to, you know, to these events, and other people are doing things as they naturally would. And I like that. And then also in terms of, so there's a question in terms of how far do they have to go? And they talked about it. We talked about it last minute, but in this minute they say, Thompson Square Park, that's over 2 miles away. You got to go. So kind of lets us know geographically the distances we're dealing with. And then also says, we've got, you know, 3 hours, 15 minutes till the end of the school day that we need to search this. So it gives us an idea of where we are in terms of time and the day. And also going back to the mention of last minute, like the FBI agents that Washington might call up from surrounding areas wouldn't get there until 3. And we know that's, you know, about three and a quarter hours away. There's a lot of information dump. But an exposition, but done in a natural way that, again, at least me, I don't know, you know, if it helped anyone else or what, you know, how anyone else thought about it. But for me as a movie viewer, kind of helped me a lot, put me in the action, into the film and kind of, you know, kept things moving along, make me more invested in what's in the action and what's going on.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so I just reviewed the this minute and I realized that the person who I always thought was Chief Allen is not Chief Allen. Chief Allen is not in a police uniform.
No, he's in a suit with like the red tie.
That's right. And that's
Chief Allen.
And that is Richard V. Allen, the NSA advisor. Now that because again, you can even see that he has the same glasses on Wikipedia as he does here. You know, this is him.
Well, yeah, because when Cobb kind of walked, there's like a half circle or, you know, a group of people that are waiting to be addressed. And he's talking to like one guy in front of him who's in in uniform. But then he turns to his right and sort of nods. And then some guy nods back. And I assume that's Chief Allen, the guy who kind of nods about halfway in the minute.
Yeah.
Or about 25 seconds in.
Okay. Yeah. And that actually is him. So there you go.
It does look a lot like the National Security Advisor to Ronald Reagan.
Yes. So they named the character after him, and there you go.
Now, I had a question. Get your opinion on what's going on with Lambert while Cobb is addressing the cops. There's a close-up, or not really, but there's like a one-shot just on Lambert, and he's kind of like doing the shifty eye looking back and forth. I wasn't sure what to read in that. Like, is he, you think he's skeptical of what Cobb is doing here? Or like, what's kind of what's going on with Lampert in this minute? Did you have any thoughts on that?
I think he's looking around at the other cops to see their reactions to the things. I think that's what it is. And Connie also in the back, you know, they're both in there looking about it. That's
because really he was in the van just now. Like, he was in on the discussion previous minute when like all this plan was laying out, the, you know, the what Cobb is communicating now. I suppose if Lampert had any objections last minute would have been the time to speak up, I guess. Yeah, so that makes sense. He's just gauging the reaction of the other other officers and officials in the crowd there.
Yeah, that would be my guess as to what he's doing there.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah. And if you look in the background, you can see that there is a store that says Hit or Miss Shop in the back. I'm trying to remember what second you can actually see it. You can see it in second 17 when Cobb is just getting to the crowd of cops. So there's a store across the street that says Hit or Miss. And so apparently this was a store that they used to have 134 stores. And in 2001, they filed for bankruptcy and ended up closing up. You know, it was a retail chain that sold the clothes. And they basically the stores started in Rhode Island, and basically they needed to, you know, they had a whole bunch of, they became a retail powerhouse during the 70s and 80s, and they reached a point where they had 575 stores by the early 90s, but then they started having trouble getting different merchandise and stuff like that, and they ended up having to file for bankruptcy at the end of 2000, which, you know, it was it used to be part of like TJ Maxx and things like that. You know, they were connected to them.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was like looking at movies from this time and, you know, see names of stores and stuff like that, and see what happened with them. You know, that type of thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So if you're trying to track locations looking for hit or miss stores in Manhattan,
you probably won't
today. There are none. There are none today.
Exactly. I mean, they basically were mostly in strip malls at the time. You know, most of their various stores. You know, which makes sense also. So, and the very last few seconds of this minute, we get to see an overhead shot of the meeting basically that Cobb is doing. And we see like the cops start to, you know, disperse and move around in different directions, you know, leaving this conversation. And that's all I have for this minute. Do you have anything else for this minute?
No, I think we covered it. We've got the line that the keep the media out of this that I mentioned last minute, kind of in contrast to the commissioner who's at you know, speaking to the press about the explosion during the day. And then, yeah, wrap it up. We get the overhead shot of all the various forces dispersing and carrying out this plan. So yep. All is going well.
Yep, so far. All right, so the script. So we have a little bit here from the script in this minute. So it says, Cobb says, "You've got 20 minutes, John. When you get something, call the police switchboard. They'll find me." McClane turns to Zeus. McClane says, "You up for this?" Zeus says, "Do I have a choice?" McClane and Zeus exit the van, hustling down the alleyway for Washington Square Park. Cobb turns to Cross and Jarvis. "I'm going to need federal help here." We cut to Wall Street to the blast site. Cobb is behind the barricades. All the police, firemen, and EMS workers are crowded in front of him. "Ricky, get the media out of here." Walsh moves off, yelling at the TV news teams. "You've got to evacuate the area now, people." Cobb continues, "I want every available man, transit cops, tri-borough authority cops, airport cops, the fire department, the EMS personnel. I want every school cordoned off. No kid can leave. And don't use your radios. And don't tell the press or we'll have the biggest panic in New York since the blackout of 1976. The cops scurry off. Cobb mutters to no one in particular, "God damn this guy." So, again, I think that this is another case where they do it well in in the movie better than in the script.
Mm-hmm.
It's much tighter here.
Yeah, I'm always strike. There's a lot more dialogue in the script than we get in these minutes. And I
well, yes they, and no, do and we don't, because you know he states here that he needs help, which we talked about yesterday in the movie. You know, from the FBI, and the FBI doesn't go into, you know, we don't have Cross say, oh, you know, I have two kids in school and I can push the panic button and all that stuff. You know, that's all gone off mm-hmm. here.
Right, right. Yeah.
That makes it more personal, I guess, hearing all those things.
Yes.
Okay, so have you ever heard of the New York blackout of 76?
Yes.
I
have.
Okay, first of all, you haven't. Because there was no New York blackout in 76. It was in 77.
Actually, I was going to say, I thought it was 78.
No, it was 77.
I knew there was a big blackout at some point in the 70s.
Yeah. Well, there was one in the 60s. There was one in, I think, 1993 or 94. They had, like, all the sitcoms dealt with it. Like, you know, Friends and Mad About You. You know, they had, like... what was it, Must See Thursday or whatever it was, that on every show they dealt with the fact that there was the same blackout that I think Chandler caused it. I don't know. I have to try and remember.
I know there was one in 2002 or 2003 that I know there was like a big, like, Northeast U.S. blackout.
Yeah, that was in 2003. That was in 2003.
Okay, 2003. Yeah. So it does happen occasionally.
Correct.
But not in 1976.
No. Well, again, maybe in their world it does. You know.
Right, in this world. Their world is just like our world, except, their blackouts are shifted by a couple of years, and their radio detonators are affected by police and FBI frequencies.
Exactly. That's that makes sense.
That makes absolute sense. That's right.
So just to talk about the connection from the Musty TV. So I was right. It was on a Friends episode. It was actually one of the very first Friends episodes. It was the episode number 7.
Very early on.
Yeah, really early on. And it apparently is considered one of just about every one of the cast members' favorite episodes, especially Matthew Perry, Rip, who he claims that this was one of his favorite episodes, because he gets stuck in a in an ATM vestibule with a model, with Jill Goodacre, I think her name was, yeah. And so it happened on other, it started from other episodes, from other shows. Okay. Mm-hmm. There were three shows that dealt with it. Seinfeld didn't incorporate the blackout premise, but they had Mad About You, where basically Jamie in Mad About You caused the blackout. And then we saw the, you know, the repercussions in Friends, and then on an episode of a TV show called The Madmen of the People, which, if I remember correctly, was with Dabney Coleman, who, again, you know, looking behind the, you know, the curtain, you know, when we're recording this, he just passed away this weekend. So.
Right. Yeah. That's fresh.
Yes.
R.I.P. Old Dabney.
Yeah. And so, that's actually very interesting that has come up here with just here, you know, just out of the blue when we're talking about a blackout. So yeah. Wow. So yeah, that's that's basically what happened. The blackout, the real blackout in our world, was July 13th and 14th, 1977.
So I was around, but I was very young and I was not living in New York City, so I don't think we were affected by the blackout.
Right. No, I was in the suburbs of New York. Right. I was living in New Jersey at the time, so I don't think it reached that far. But they had a big crime crisis that night because of that. There was a lot of looting mm-hmm. and and robberies and stuff like that because of the fact that everything was completely blacked out.
Right.
Yeah. So that's all I have for that. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Trilogy Tuesday, where my guests will give their top five movie trilogies. So what have you got for us, Sean?
Yeah, this is a tough one. This is your various homework assignments that you give out to your guests, because there's a lot of good series that there's more than three, so they don't qualify. And then there's a lot of good series where there's like two good ones, and then there's one kind of dud in the mix. So I kind of left those out. They didn't make the cut. So but getting to getting to the actual quote unquote trilogies, and I did kind of push the definition a little bit.
Yeah,
I'm going to start with the.
I'm a little free with the definition. It's okay.
I know, as you are a generous grader on these assignments,
Yeah, of
so
course.
we certainly appreciate that. So I'm going to start with the Evil Dead trilogy from Sam Raimi, and starting with Evil Dead in 1981, Evil Dead 2, and then Army of Darkness. I mean, it's not called Evil Dead 3, but it's the same main character with Bruce Campbell. It's following on Ash. It's a definitely a trilogy there. So I put those together. Evil Dead trilogy from Sam Raimi. For number four, I'm going to go with a series of documentaries, a trilogy of documentaries, and that is The Decline of Western Civilization, directed by Penelope Spheeris. And that covers music. So the first one, Decline of Western Civilization, covered a kind of hardcore punk in the early 80s and just had a series of performances and short interviews with band members and, fans, members of the crowd covering the punk scene. Then for Decline of Western Civilization 2, covered heavy metal. And then for number three, back to the punk scene, punk bands and their fans and the scene there. So but that's a very good trilogy of documentaries there. The Decline of Western Civilization. For number three, I had Peter Jackson's The Lord of the Rings, which is a great trilogy and an even greater backstory on how that got made, just the scope of work and just the what he had to go through. There was a series recently on the Vice Channel here in the US. It's called Icons Unearthed. And they do kind of pop culture icons. They've had a series on The Simpsons and a series on Batman and a series on Star Wars. And they recently did 6 episodes, 6 hours, just on the making of, the Lord of the Rings films. They do a little bit of background on Tolkien and the books, but it's mainly just to kind of fill in a little bit of background to get to the process of making those movies. And that's, that just watching the making of is almost as thrilling as watching the films, the movies themselves.
Yeah,
So that's my number
I have
three.
the extended edition DVDs,
Extended.
and there they
Yeah.
have so much about the making of the movie. Unbelievable. Hours and hours
Yeah.
of fun.
Yeah. Lots of entertainment there. Lots of entertainment value. So Lord of the Rings, number three. Number two, kind of pushing the definition again, I'm going to say Indiana Jones, and I'm guessing I'm not the first or the only guest, and only counting the first three. So Raiders of the Lost Ark, Temple of Doom, and then Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade as the trilogy there. I think there's a big break in time and in quality when you get
I think
to
the quality is the
any further
reason.
films in that series.
I think quality is more of a reason to get rid of the other two. Yeah, I agree with
Although
you on that.
I just rewatched. It was I watched with my partners. It was my first rewatch of Dial of Destiny since seeing it in the theater, and her first time, Catherine, my partner, her first time seeing it. And the consensus was it's okay. It's not bad,
I like the
but not
first.
good enough.
I like the first quarter. The first quarter is like amazing, and then the rest of it just doesn't live up to it. That was my feeling about it.
Yeah, but yeah, so not good enough to get included in those first three films. with Indiana Jones really fit together well. And so that's, I'm calling that a trilogy.
Okay.
And then, and I want to mention a couple honorable mentions. There are things that had four films that I thought were good enough. I couldn't cut one film out and make it a trilogy to fit into this category. There's National Lampoon's Vacation, which you've got Vacation and then European Vacation and Christmas Vacation.
And then Vegas.
But the Vegas Vacation, which I think the main storyline, the whole thing with Beverly D'Angelo and Wayne Newton, like that doesn't work for me. You know, it's kind of like the A storyline or the A plot line doesn't work. But the side stories, the B stories with the kids and their adventures in Las Vegas, I think it's a lot of fun. It's funny. I think that's still a good film. So you've got a group of four there, so not a trilogy. Toy Story is another one where you've got four good films, four solid films. I wouldn't cut one off to make that a trilogy. And then The Batman from 89 through 97 with Tim Burton directing the Batman Begins, Batman Forever, and then Batman and Robin. Again, I know, like, I think Batman and Robin is lots of campy fun. It's not as serious as the first two. So maybe it doesn't fit in thematically, but I still think it's fun and it's good. So I'm going to count that as, you know, as a foursome, a quadrology. So,
okay.
Those are the honorable mentions that when you mention like a series of films, they were, you know, among my thoughts, but didn't make the cut because not trilogies. So then yeah, my number one trilogy is, the old school Star Wars trilogy, Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, the, you know, science fiction space opera from my youth. That's the number one. That's the one I most enjoy. Those are the films that I go back and rewatch most often. That's going to be, Star Wars, old school, 70s, early 80s, number one trilogy.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen that. Maybe I should check that out.
You should check those. They're pretty good films. They hold up okay. You should check them out.
All right, I'll take a look at this.
Yeah.
All right, great. Thank you for that list. Sean, why don't you tell everyone where they can find Sean German?
All right, so once again, you want to hear me talk more about movies and pop culture and all kinds of other stuff, I'm at nextscenepod.com with the Next Scene podcast. And also coming up later in 2024, I'll be covering the Warner Brothers classic Casablanca, 1 minute at a time, and that's at casablancaminute.com.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. And you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Johnny comes marching home again. Hurrah, hurrah. Them a hearty welcome then. Hurrah, hurrah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.